Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. I confess to a slight distaste in so often writing and speaking on the subject of the Jews. They are a most unpleasant race on the whole. Their religion is base and primitive and unworthy even of analysis. Their ethnocentrism is little more than crude hatred for all other peoples. Their sexuality is by turns both insanely repressive and grossly degenerate. Their admittedly high average intelligence can most charitably be described as predatory. And though there are exceptions who are probably hybrids, those who look most characteristically Jewish are frankly repulsive. If they had confined themselves to some small spot in the Levant, selling their rags, telling fortunes, and swindling the locals, I doubt I should notice them much at all. I'd no more likely be discussing them on American Dissident Voices than discussing the tribes of Bahrain or Yemen. But through a series of extraordinary events, the Jews developed a nomadic and parasitic mode of life and have forced themselves on us, have largely replaced our own ruling class, have tricked our people out of much of their wealth, have snookered us into dying in their wars, and are intentionally and with malice aforethought pursuing policies that will certainly lead to our extinction. The fact that these same policies will also likely lead to their own extinction is small solace. So I, and you, if you are a thoughtful man or woman, so we are forced to notice them, understand them, and defend ourselves against them. Who are these people, and why do they do the things they do to us? The answer can be found in Jewish genes and Jewish memes. Jewish genes have always been less than pure, and today they are less so than ever. And Jewish memes, the myths that define them, such as the chosen people myth, have only imperfectly guided this very mixed group's evolution in a Jewish direction. There have always been those Jews, probably those the least Jewish in biological terms, who have fallen away and ceased overtly being Jews. I'm not here referring to Morenos or secret Jews who, to preserve themselves and their wealth and positions in society, faked a conversion to Christianity centuries ago, but maintained their Jewish identity and even rituals in secret. Sometimes, by the way, these Moreno families forgot or feigned to forget their Jewish identities. A man of my acquaintance knew a family of Spanish origins, nominally Catholics, who had a family tradition of every Passover placing black cloth over the crucifixes and other Christian symbols in their home. They professed not to know the origin of the practice. But I am thinking, for example, of a man in the Washington, D.C. area who, despite having, as far as he knew, entirely Jewish ancestry and a Jewish upbringing, always thought of himself as a white man. He abandoned Judaism, and when he became aware of the threats to white survival posed by the policies of the Jewish power structure, he opposed those policies and supported, with total sincerity as far as I could see, efforts by whites to regain control of our destiny. And he's still doing that to this day. I am thinking of the young Jewish man who wrote to the National Alliance in the mid-1990s, looking for support for a plan to force Jews to return a substantial percentage of the wealth they had taken from our society at large. Despite his abandonment of the Jewish religion and power structure, he was looking out, he said, for the long-term interests of both host and parasite. He believed that his plan would prevent the otherwise inevitable bloodshed that would occur when whites discovered how they had been bled nearly to death by the Jewish minority. One thinks of Benjamin Harrison Friedman, a wealthy Jew, the attending physician at whose birth in 1890 was none other than Bernard Baruch's father, who was at the center of the Jewish handlers who controlled Woodrow Wilson, in Friedman's words, like a poodle on a string. Friedman became so disgusted by the manipulation and lies and by the death and destruction that resulted from the nefarious acts of the Jewish power structure that he defected from it and devoted the rest of his life until his death in 1984 to exposing its crimes. I've taken a prominent role in preventing Friedman's works from being shoved down the memory hole. One also thinks of Shlomo Sand, an Israeli academic who recently penned the book, How I Stopped Being a Jew. Sand is an interesting case. Fully Jewish by religious standards, his mother was a Jew, he is half-Jewish genetically, with a non-Jewish father, presumably European, judging by his looks and the fact that he was born in Austria. Sand, a leftist and anti-racist, is repelled not only by Zionist atrocities, but also by the biological ethnocentrism of many Jews, which he denies has any basis in fact. Sand can help us start to understand this strange people who have attached themselves to us. In an earlier book, The Invention of the Jewish People, Sand argues that a huge proportion of today's Jews are descendants of disparate groups of converts to Judaism with little genetic affinity and therefore no legitimate biological claim to peoplehood, and certainly no legitimate claim to possession of Palestine. And Sand certainly has a point. One need only look at a Russian Jew, a Yemeni Jew, and an Ethiopian Jew to know that the Jews, if a race at all, are a very mixed one. Jewish author John Entin, author of Abraham's Children, Race, Identity, and the DNA of the Chosen People, takes nearly the opposite view, bringing together many genetic studies of Jews to prove his point. Entin states that prior to the middle of the 20th century, Jewish intermarriage with non-Jews was an astonishingly low 0.5%. And he emphasizes that Jews, whatever their origins, are more closely related to each other than to their host populations, adding that more than 75% of Jews can trace some of their ancestry to the Middle East, which of course means that about a quarter of them can't. He also brings up the fact that Ashkenazi Jews, who form 80% of world Jewry, have inherited nearly 50% of their mitochondrial DNA from white European women. Entin theorizes that the ancestors of the Ashkenazi Jews spread out from the Middle East into Italy in Roman times and into the rest of Europe from there. Proto-Ashkenazi populations were small, and at first, males seeking new opportunities traveled to new lands in very small numbers, taking white women as wives in many cases. Entin doesn't know whether or not these European women were converted to Judaism or not, but he notes that Judaism once proselytized, though it would eventually cease doing so for all practical purposes. There were times, including quite recent times, when the rate of intermarriage for Jews fell to a very low level, as Entin states, but this early proto-Ashkenazi period clearly was not one of them. The biblical scholar Thomas L. Thompson, in his book The Mythic Past, proves beyond a reasonable doubt that the Jews' own tales about their origins, found in their Torah, what Christians call the Old Testament, while psychologically revealing, have no historical basis. He states, quote, There is no evidence of a united monarchy, no evidence of a capital in Jerusalem, or of any coherent, unified political force that dominated Western Palestine, let alone an empire of the size the legends describe. We do not have evidence for the existence of kings named Saul, David, or Solomon, nor do we have evidence for any temple at Jerusalem in this early period. Close quote. Thompson concludes that the traditional Jewish narrative was partly borrowed and partly concocted by agitators attempting to religiously and politically unite disparate Semitic tribes who had been displaced by the misfortunes of war and empire in the Middle East during the last few centuries BC. This confirms some of the key contentions of Shlomo Sand. Thus we see that the memes of Jewish peoplehood began with lies, and it is my contention that these memes, these lies, have had a race formation effect on those who adopted them, and that this race formation effect has continued to operate even after the incorporation of non-Semitic genes into the Jewish gene pool. Although Jewish organizations preach integration and racial equality for white Americans, and despite the fact of their own quite mixed background, Jews themselves are among the most racially exclusive peoples on earth. They have their own special schools for their children, where non-Jews are not permitted. They have their own media of newspapers and magazines intended for Jewish consumption only, in which they rail against the evils of intermarriage with non-Jews and promote the idea that they are a special, chosen race, decreed by God to be holier than all others and therefore deserving of special treatment from the rest of us. Why this seeming contradiction? Why is it integration and conquest by third world immigration for us and racial exclusiveness and superiority for them? The answer can be found in the Jews' special mode of life. Living as they always have, as a tiny minority among other peoples, allowing general intermarriage would quickly have resulted in the disappearance of the Jews as a distinct people. Their genes containing those qualities that mark them as distinctly Jewish would have been completely swamped by mixture with the genes of their more numerous host peoples. If they were to survive, they needed a religion and a moral code which discouraged mixture with non-Jews. They needed a theology which exalted them above other peoples. They created exactly that in their myth of the chosen people, and it has served them well. But, you might object, there has been intermarriage. Yes, indeed there has, and to such an extent that many Jews today, whose ancestors have spent countless generations among the people of Europe, look, at least to an untrained eye, as white as any European. But nevertheless, despite and in some ways because of this intermixture, the chosen people myth has been and still is a powerful force which has preserved the essence of Jewish uniqueness. To understand how this seeming contradiction can be so, you have to understand the basic scientific fact that behavioral tendencies, character, and personality are largely genetic, and are passed on from generation to generation with mathematical precision according to the characteristics of the parents and their parents, and so on back into the mists of time. The essence of Jewishness is not in their distinctive appearance, which some Jews have largely lost over the centuries, nor in their peculiar modes of dress or diet or expression, which many non-religious Jews have abandoned anyway, without in any way relinquishing their Jewishness. No, the essence of Jewishness is the special us versus them mentality, which is formalized in their chosen people myth, and which was necessary for their survival as a tiny group among the teeming masses of Egypt, Babylon, Rome, and America. The key is this. In the first place, early Jews were those Semites to whom the ethnocentric and genocidal memes of what we now call the Old Testament were attractive. So even at the very earliest period at which Jews appear, we have a select, distinct, and peculiar group. Then, for thousands of years, the Jews were subjected to a rigorous process of genetic selection. Those Jews in whom this us versus them mentality, this intense ethnocentrism or racism, was weak or absent, were the most likely to intermarry and the least likely to raise their offspring as Jews or induce their spouse to undergo the difficult and officially discouraged conversion process. Thus, the genetic material of these less racist Jews was lost to Jewry. Thus, over the centuries, those Jews who remained in the fold were those who possessed these special mental qualities to a greater degree. And these qualities became intensified over the years, since only those who possessed them to the highest degree were the progenitors of the following generations of the people who called themselves Jews. The fact that there has been a definitely observable drift of white genetic material into the gene pool of European and American Jews does not substantially change the situation as I have described it. When intermarriage occurred despite the opposition of the conservative and religious elements, and the offspring were raised as Jews, a similar selection process took place among them. Those to whom the chosen people myth and the attitudes and practices that accompany it were incongenial or repugnant escaped into the wider Gentile world and did not contribute their genes to the Jewish people. Those who had inherited the special mentality that characterizes the Jewish mode of life became part of the Jewish people, and the parents of Jewish children. Even though they often brought with them such non-Jewish characteristics as straight fine hair, light coloration, and straight or upturned noses. Looking at this situation from a purely biological perspective, this acquiring of some of the physical characteristics of their host peoples might have been a survival advantage to the Jews, since it blurred the distinction between themselves and their hosts, at least to the hosts, and the Gentiles' consciousness of their foreignness had always been a danger to them. In fact, it was and still remains their greatest fear. They call it antisemitism. The term is really a poor one, since it is never applied toward those who dislike Arabs, who are relatively pure Semites, but always to those who criticize Jews, who today are only partly Semitic, and who have themselves probably killed more Semites than any other people. This fear of our recognition of their foreignness is natural. To the nations which have expelled or fought them over the centuries, and the list is a long one, including Egypt, Rome, Spain, England, France, Russia, Germany, and many others, the reason was the resentment of the peoples of those lands when these peculiar foreigners became rich and powerful and had the ears of the political leaders, while the rightful owners of the land felt dispossessed of their own birthright. This process has occurred many times throughout history, and it is occurring again in the United States of America right now. The Jews perceive any reaction against their presence in the host nations as persecution. And from their point of view, Perhaps it is persecution, since our reaction is against the only way of life they know, that of a parasite attached to a host. Our interests are irreconcilable. To protect themselves from any reaction from the host population, the Jews promote the doctrine that there is no difference among the races, although among themselves they cherish the doctrine of not only the superiority, but the actual divinity of their race. Jews desire to erase any feelings of racial identity among their hosts, and to that end they have done two things. On the one hand, they have used their money and their influence to change the composition of our society through the immigration of myriads of aliens of every race, culture, and description. In a cosmopolitan society, in which nearly every other person is an alien of some type, is a society in which the differentness of the Jew is well obscured. In addition, they have used their money and their influence to change the moral climate in this country. Traditionally, America was Eurocentric, exactly as the multiculturalists claim. Our traditions, our way of doing things, our values, our art and literature and architecture, and our genetic heritage, which ultimately determines all of those things, were all European. Interracial sex and homosexuality were punishable crimes in almost every state of the Union. But today, our politicians and our talking heads of the media preach exactly the opposite, and Jewish groups like the Anti-Defamation League are pushing for so-called hate crime laws to make it a crime to recognize racial differences or to criticize in any way the conversion of America into a third world country. Never forget that the pattern for such laws was set in the Jewish-dominated early Soviet Union, where the punishment for anti-Semitism was often the gulag or death. The Jewish power structure does these things because they believe that they are necessary for the survival of the nation, state, people, race, and religion of the Jews. We deem these things destructive and as an arrow aimed at our people's heart. They deem them necessary. Between these two positions, no compromise is possible. But there is hope, actually a great deal of hope. Although the rate of Jewish intermarriage may have been 0.5% within the lifetimes of my older listeners, if John Antine is right, the situation has radically changed today, with intermarriage figures hovering around the 50% mark. No people can survive such an onslaught for long, intelligent genes and powerful memes notwithstanding. Though we are threatened, demographically, whites stand in a much better position than Jews today. The falling away from Jewish identity I spoke about earlier is going to accelerate. And as I've shown on previous programs, despite their prodigious talent for undermining and controlling other people's nations, awareness of Jewish power is on the rise worldwide. Jews are nothing if not extreme, and reaction to Jewish excesses, often including expulsion of the Jews, has traditionally followed Jewish domination and their usual over-the-top lording it over their subject peoples. It's happened in numerous countries, time after time. The difference is that today the venue for Jewish exploitation and overt and covert rule is not just France or England or Palestine, but half or more of the civilized world. It is a global phenomenon, and the burgeoning reaction to it is also global. There will be nowhere to disappear to this time. It's probably true that the 1% is 99% Jewish, but that's a lot less of an advantage when everyone knows it. We National Alliance members are in the forefront of building that awareness. Join us. You've been listening to American Dissident Voices, the radio program of the National Alliance, founded by William Luther Pierce in 1970. This program is published every week at whitebiocentrism.com and nationalvanguard.org. Please write to us at National Alliance, Box 172, Laurel Bloomery, Tennessee, 37680, USA. We welcome your support, your inquiries, and your help in spreading our message of hope to our people. Once again, that address is Box 172, Laurel Bloomery, Tennessee, 37680, USA. Until next week, this is Kevin Alfred Strom reminding you of the words of Richard Berkeley Cotton. Freedom is not free. Free men are not equal, and equal men are not free.
For blood and for soil, we will work, we will toil. Heaven is born on the earth. The heroes arise as we shout to the skies. We will now have our rebirth.